right, Shane? Right now, to break out the case. So, Rabbi Zaitzik asked me to speak about Hanukkah, because Rabbi Zaitzik thinks that it's very easy to speak about Hanukkah. And we were looking for titles, and I just didn't have a title. Discovering Today's Darkness with a Brilliant Light of Hanukkah. And that's a generic title. And the truth is, Hanukkah, I find, is the hardest holiday to speak about. Now, for me, it's hard for me to get out of my childhood mode, so Hanukkah always meant gifts. Hanukkah gelt, playing dreidel, or a little bit of a shark that way, and it was a lot of money. It was money, Hanukkah gelt, and gifts, and that's what it always meant to me. And, you know, lighting the Hanukkah candles was also nice. Family got together and sang, and it was very, very beautiful. And that's Hanukkah. And that's what Hanukkah is for most of us. Very breezy, light-hearted holiday. Very, very beautiful. And in fact, if one looks at the literature, one finds that it's much more complicated, much more complex than that. And in certain ways, very depressing, not uplifting. So, now Rabbi Zaitzik told me that the session, just so you know, if anybody objects, tell me now, because I can cut it down. Is about 45 minutes. Okay, is that correct? Everybody's expecting 45 minutes?
I said an hour and 45 minutes.
I know. I know what you said, but you have a very good sense of humor, so I understood that. Okay, so I really have, what I wanted to present tonight is really two parts. And I think really the two sides of the same coin. The first is, what exactly took place with the Greeks, the Syrian Greeks, and the Jews? Why can't we all just get along? What was the issue? What was the problem? And then once we discuss the problem, I think it will be interesting to know, so then why do we celebrate the way we celebrate? And when we discuss the problem, we'll see it might be unusual to celebrate the way we do, and the accent on what we accentuate. So, using very classical sources, which I'm going to use. So, basically, we say, if you go on Wikipedia and you look up Hanukkah, it's an ancient holiday, celebrated, and it says, because it was the victory that the Maccabean Jews had over the Syrian Greeks. And then it proceeds to tell you a little bit about that. And in our classical literature, we don't have much about that. What they cite is really from Maccabees, the Book of Maccabees, which is not part of the canon. It's not part of the Jewish scripture. It's not part of the Tanakh. It's a book that's from the Sfarim Chitzonim. It's the Apocrypha, the pseudepigrapha, a body of literature which we never saved. It was saved by the Catholic Church. We have it because of them. And if you look at the Jewish sources, it doesn't really speak much about what you find in 1 Maccabees and 2 Maccabees. But it really speaks about what it was that the Greeks wanted from the Jews. Now, you know that the Greeks brought enlightenment, Hellenism, enlightenment to the entire world. And every place they went, they were welcomed and they were embraced. Because at their own expense, they would build the roads, they would build modern buildings, modern plumbing. They were able to draw water. Nobody was able to do that in the ancient world. For that time, modern bathroom facilities. They built wonderful and majestic coliseums. And they brought the aesthetic value of the arts and of culture and of math and of science and philosophy, every discipline that really animated ancient civilization. And everybody embraced them. They welcomed the Greeks. So what was the snag with the Jews? And in fact, if you look at the history, when Alexander the Great came to Israel the very first time, he was embraced. He was embraced by Simon the Just, Shimon HaKohen. He embraced him, and there's a story in the Talmud of their meeting, a historic meeting of mutual respect and honor. As a matter of fact, the Jewish name, Alexander, many Jews are called Alexander, is because after that meeting, there was a decree that every Jewish boy born in the next year would be called Alexander. So you have this very, very beautiful initial relationship that the Greeks had with the Jews. But then the Talmud tells us that the Greeks said, you know, it's a great relationship. What we really need to do is we need to enlighten you. We need to educate you. Because you're wonderful people, but you're very primitive. And you have these ancient beliefs, some of them barbaric, and we need to teach you the more modern, sophisticated, intellectual approach to life. And interestingly enough, the way that they were going to teach the Jews about this sophisticated, enlightened way of living is that they said, we have to first thing, ab initio, we have to abolish three of your practices. You know, practices that are not going to work going forward. And some of them seem innocuous. The Jews used to sanctify the month. It's called Kiddush HaChodesh. As a matter of fact, we still do that. If you go to shul a week before the new month, they'll have a prayer. And we pray that God grant us the new month, and we ask for all of God's blessings. And there are people here who love Chazanim, and they know they go specially for Shabbos Mevorachim. They go, they'll walk extra additional miles to hear a great Chazan of Shabbos Mevorachim. And these Greeks said, no, we'll teach you opera. But none of this Kiddush HaChodesh stuff. We don't like that. They also abolished Shabbos. You have to be productive. You have to work. What's this nonsense? You take off a whole 25 hours. We don't do that. We're productive. You don't get a day off. If the gods wanted it to be 6 days, they would have created 6 days. They made 7 days. And the third was they abolished circumcision. No circumcision. Okay, I would think that we can work with that. 613 mitzvahs, they wipe out three. Okay, they left the 600. It should really work. But for some reason it didn't work. And the question that we really would ask is, why did they single out these three? If there are 613, just three. And why these three? And the answer is that if you analyze these three precepts, you find that they all are involved in one principle, a unique principle, a Jewish principle, a principle that's not shared, and certainly was not shared by the Greeks, but it's not even shared by Western civilization. And that is that these three, more than the other 610 mitzvos, all of them have to do with sanctification, to sanctify. And that word in Hebrew for sanctification is the word kadosh. Kadosh, holy. Kadosh, kadosh, kadosh. Holy, holy, holy. A very important phrase that we have. And the idea is that kadosh, holy, is something that the Greeks could not comprehend. And many aspects of Jewish life, the most important aspects of Jewish life, are based upon sanctification. And we know that. Marriage. What do Jews call marriage? Can there be anything more basic to the human species than marriage? Happily married people, love, romance. It's called kiddushin, sanctification. We sanctify that union. That when people are married, keep in mind that before the Jews, there wasn't marriage in the traditional sense. It was basically a single scene. You got married for a day, and then that was the end of it. You got married the next day, a little bit like Redstone. Come to Redstone. Different person every day. So that the Jews created something called a dedicated monogamous relationship, sanctified. And that's called Kiddushin. We constantly on Friday we say Kiddush. We usher in the holiday, we usher in the Sabbath by saying Kiddush, sanctify. And the same thing is true when you go to shul, the prayer that's repeated the most often every prayer service is Kaddish, to sanctify. So that this idea of Kiddusha, of holiness, is something which is unique to the Jewish people. And that's the hidden meaning behind all of those mitzvahs. Because Judaism, and the essence of Judaism, is to try to sanctify the world around us. There's a world that we believe God created, and God says, sanctify this world. And we try to do that. And we try to sanctify everything around us. For the Greeks, that was something that was a non-starter. What does that mean, sanctify? Sanctify. The God, small g, gave us this magnificent world. And in this world, there are beautiful things. There's an aesthetic value to everything that we see. And the human mind can aesthetically project many disciplines. So that's what the world's essence is, the beauty of the world. The beauty of a flower, the beautiful beauty of a sunset. If you want to speak about the moon, the full moon outside right now, so the Greeks would say, look at the beauty of that orb, that celestial body that gives light in the nighttime. It's beautiful. Let's look at its dimensions, let's look at its various shapes. That's how they would look at it, because as far as they were concerned, that was the sum total of living. Aesthetics. Beauty. Yafteh lokim lo yefes v'yishkom ba'or le'shem. And for them, that was sufficient. They needed nothing else. Anything that was additional to that was sanctimonious. Anything that was additional to that took away from the beauty. Certainly, sanctification was foreign to them. You know, of course, for the Jewish people, the aesthetic value is also very important. It's critical, because we believe in everything that is in this world was created for a purpose. And we can find the aesthetic value, the beauty. And we know that Judaism has a very, very deep appreciation for things that are beautiful. As a matter of fact, if you look at the Psalms, in all of the Psalms, we find this sensitivity to the beauty of the world. And to everything that the Greeks found beauty to, the Jews found beauty as well. However, that's not enough for the Jewish people. That's not enough. God said beauty alone is not enough to carry the day. It's insufficient unless you invest it with holiness. Anything that is beautiful and is invested with holiness, it becomes sanctified. And if it becomes sanctified, it becomes meaningful. And those are the three mitzvahs and the reason that they oppose them. Because all three personified sanctification. Now what's this Rosh Chodesh bit that they would have? This is what they did. It sounds almost weird. You would have people all over Israel knowing when the new moon was approximately when the new moon would appear. Everybody knows what the new moon is? The moon waxes, just to make sure. The moon waxes and wanes at the very, very end of the month. Right? Every lunar month is 29 days, 12 hours, 59 minutes, and approximately 19 seconds. It's the same. The universe works like clockwork. But different times of the year, you could see the new moon one night, and sometimes you have to wait for the next night. Because the end of the month, the crescent is on the left side, and the new month, the crescent begins on the right side. When they would see that, they would get on their horses, even on Shabbos, and they would rush to Jerusalem, they would go to the high court, to the Sanhedrin, and they would say, oh, we saw a new moon. They would examine them to see if they were telling the truth, and then the entire 71 rabbis would sit in that beautiful hewn room adjacent to the Holy Temple, and they would say, Mekudash, Mekudash. Now the moon is sanctified, and all of our holidays are based upon that sanctification. And the Greeks reviled that. The idea to sanctify the natural universe. The universe is beautiful. It doesn't need any additional input from you. And it was for them it was an abomination. Kiddush Levana, we sanctify the moon. We go out. We look like moon worshippers to the person who is uneducated. But in fact, what we do is we regal in this idea that we can take something which is mundane, beautiful but mundane, and we can inject it and invest it with something which is holy, something which is meaningful. Now, every intelligent creature in the ancient world realized that the world, the universe, was vast and that it was awe-inspiring. Everybody knew that. You didn't have to be very wise. But the Greeks were so struck by the awesomeness of the universe and of nature that they worship nature itself as a deity. Now, without getting involved in Dionysian and other kinds of cults that existed in the early, the middle, the late Greek periods, it was very orgiastic. Everything was involved in nature. And orgiastic rites, without getting too detailed, everybody knows what I mean, all of it is really natural. There's nothing wrong with being natural. And natural means doing anything that you like, because they worshiped it. They worshiped it as a deity. As a matter of fact, all of the days of the week are named after the celestial bodies. Sunday is the sun, and Monday is the moon. Tuesday is Mars. Wednesday is Venus. Right? Saturn is Saturday. Every single day of the week was a different planet. That's what they worshipped. They worshipped all of their gods were beautiful. If you think about Athena, perfect woman. You think about Zeus, you think about Cronus, you think about Apollo. These are all Adonis. These are all people who are perfect. Their bodies are perfect. Because that's what they worship and that's what they invested all of their effort into. But the Jews invested the world with holiness. Something beyond the aesthetic. And the way that they did that was by showing that all of the beauty and all of the power and all of the majesty is really generated by God. They brought it back to where it came from, and that was important. They didn't cut it off at where it existed, but they said, well, how did it come into existence? Oh, it comes from God. God is the ultimate scientist. God is the ultimate philosopher. God is the ultimate artist and sculptor. God is that ultimate power. That's what sanctity means. Sanctity means to invest it with godliness. And that's what the Jews did, because God created everything. And therefore, Rosh Chodesh is for the Jew to sanctify time. We kill time. That's the phrase we use in America. But I have nothing to do. Let's kill time. These days you don't have to kill time. You just look at your iPhone. Your 5A, 5B, your 6, your 7, 8 is coming out soon. That's how we spend our time. That's what we do. But sanctification of time. On a day like Shabbos, when you sanctify time, you're not looking at the iPhone. Or at least you're not supposed to. But you're supposed to think about things that are holy. And Shabbos and Yom Tov are all of that. We say, Mikadesh Yisrael v'hazmanim. That's what the Jews do. And then you eat the brisket. But first you sanctify. First you understand why we're here and why we do it. And nothing is lost. One can fully appreciate all of the culture, all of the aesthetics of the world. But to add, to augment to this additional dimension, that's what the Jews did. And the Greeks could not deal with it. For them it was an abomination. It was an insult to the gods. And when you speak about the mark of circumcision, to them, if you remember reading Virgil and Cicero, who would quote what the Greeks said, and the Romans said it as well, they said that the idea of taking a human being that was created by the gods, which is perfection, the gods created perfect bodies, and for the Jews to defile that body, for the Jews to remove part of that body, as far as they were concerned, it was a sacrilege. It was something that they could not abide, because it represents for us the sanctification of the physical. That's why it is in the organ, which is the most material, the most representative of the physical. And some people can make it into a vulgarity. But for the Jews, it's not a vulgarity. Sex is a beautiful gift that Hashem gives the Jewish people, that He gives the world. But it's sanctified. And that's why it has to be in this kind of a monogamous, dedicated relationship, because it's holy. And it's invested with holiness, with love, with romance, with dedication, and with loyalty. And they couldn't deal with that. They couldn't deal with the idea that we have the circumcision to show that we can control our urges, that we can sublimate everything that it is that is physical. But a person can sanctify themselves, and that's why if you go to a bris and you listen carefully to the mohel, before he does that, he goes, bris kodesh, before he even does his work. Bris kodesh. It's not just merely circumcision, it's bris kodesh. It's to sanctify that young lad as he enters into the Jewish people. And so, as I mentioned, to the Greeks, it was something of an abomination, because you glorified the body. As you know, one of the innovations that Menelaus brought, this is in 2 Maccabees, Menelaus brought into the temple was for there to be a gymnasium where all of the men had to be naked. There was a whole, without getting involved in that, there was a whole kind of an operation that many of the Jews who were the Hellenized Jews would go through to somehow use a kind of plastic surgery to mask their circumcision. And that is something that the Greeks had to battle. And therefore, the battle of Hanukkah was not about Hellenizing the Jews by changing the streets and by bringing modern equipment into Israel, but it was really something about undoing everything that Judaism stood for, which is the notion of sanctification. And for them, everything had to be profane. Everything had to be without any scintilla of holiness. You know, this is not something that is new. What I am saying is not something, maybe the context is new. But if you remember from your college days, or even if you continue to study after college, if you remember, there was a great British social critic who lived in the end of the 19th century. His name was Matthew Arnold. Very, very famous, very, very famous individual. And he wrote a book called Culture and Anarchy. You may remember it from college, if you took classical civilization or if you took 19th century European history. Did you? Okay, I did. I wanted my father's tuition dollars to work. And in it, he differentiated between the Greeks and the Jews. And he said, and he was sympathetic to the Greeks, because they gave us Western civilization. And he said that the world of Hellenism and the world of Hebraism, he called it Jewish Hebraism, because we were called Hebrews until recently, he said, you can easily describe both of them. He says Hellenism is about art and it's about nature and about imagination. And in essence, he says, its great ideal was beauty. The Jews, Hebraism, he says, is not about those things. It's about ethics and duties and obligations. It has ideals and is based upon righteousness. These are not words that you find to describe the Greeks. And if you know Greek history, you know that they were not involved totally in ethics. They spoke about ethics, but they were not totally involved in living an ethical life or a moral life or certainly righteousness. And in fact, if you look at our society, and Matthew Arnold was trying to project ahead into the 20th century, and we've lived through that century, we're in the 21st century, but if you project and you look at the secular culture that developed, it developed in Europe at the end of the 19th century, and it developed here in the United States the second half, because we were puritanical to begin with, in the second half of the 20th century, you know that we do still deify the body without getting involved in how much money we spend on cosmetics and beauty, how much money we spend on fashion, all of the things to make the body beautiful. And I'm not, believe me, my wife has 3 credit cards that are not yet maxed out. So we understand that the need for all of these things. But it's something that we should realize is something that's very Greek about us. And the same thing is true about science. We believe in science until it changes, right? If you're involved in nutrition and the scientists tell you don't eat this, and then 5 years later they say, no. It's the other stuff we told you to eat that you shouldn't be eating. You should eat this. But we go along, we go with the flow, we never question. Never question. And skepticism about religion. As you know, religion is, for many people, is a non-starter, even in America. Without, I'm not quoting Donald Trump as a person to quote, although I have to be respectful. He's the president. He would be the president of the United States. But just last night, when he was in Minnesota, or Wisconsin, I'm sorry, he said, you were my first stop when I started my entire project of becoming president. And at that time, I gave a speech, and I said, one day I'm going to come back and say Merry Christmas. Because you're not allowed to say it, as you know. And he went back last night, and he said it. And that's like, that was big news. That was big news. And a lot of people were very angry. How dare he say, could you imagine this? Could you imagine this? In the United States of America, basically a Protestant country, and you can't even say it. You can't even say it. You have to have a person who's like a upstart, somebody who's shunned by all of the intelligent people, in quotes, to be able to say something about a holiday. Because we have skepticism about religion. And we've achieved a kind of quasi-religious worship of other kinds of things. No different than the Greeks. Our football players and our basketball players and our baseball players. And now that we have a lot of documented and undocumented people, soccer, this is what we spend our time. I know that in the synagogue, and I'm not saying it just to our synagogue, and most synagogues, it's difficult for people to sit for more than a half hour. And they get fidgety. What's going on? And yet, on a Sunday, on a Thanksgiving, on the 25th and the 26th coming, people will be able to sit watching football games and marathon. 3 hours, and then you stop for a little snap, quick, next game is on, you got your Rose Bowl, you got all of the bowls. Yet we're able to do that because there's a kind of a quasi-deification of sport, about the body, about athletics. And Baruch Hashem, brutal sports are now legal in New York State. And in the very last MMA match that they had, the first one that they had, you couldn't buy a ticket for less than $600. And that was the nosebleed section. But the front row seats for $6,000 each. $6,000 each to watch two people pummel each other. And we're civilized people. And we say, no, it's aesthetics. It's aesthetics. Did you see that move? Did you see it? Did you see that elbow to the head? Did you see how he crushed his nose? That was a beautiful strike. He's a striker, you know. And we don't even analyze that. We don't even think about it. Certainly not sanctification. So that the values of Judaism have to deal with the sanctity of things, the sanctity of life. For us, life is holy. Every moment of life is holy. Chaye Sha'a, even a moment of life, is something which is very, very holy. And this goes up against, without being a muckraker, this goes up against many of the new values in medicine, which is the person's old. The person's not going to have a meaningful life. So just, and we have fancy words for killing somebody. Whatever. I don't want to get involved in that. But that's what Judaism is. Judaism thinks about the sanctity of life. It thinks about the consecration of marriage. That there's nothing wrong with celebrating a 50th wedding anniversary. It's something that we would extol, not as go sucker. And we also believe in modesty. We also believe in the inner worth of a human being, not just the external worth of the human being. And the truth is, we derive more inspiration from the wise men of Athens than we derive inspiration from the wise men of Jerusalem. That's the state that the Greeks created for the Jewish people. And that was part of what the Hanukkah was about. And while the ancient Greeks gave the world tragedy, right? The Greek tragedy, that's what they taught us, that life is tragic. Life really doesn't have a good ending. All of us are really pawns in the hands of the gods. And their gods are very capricious. And the gods are very, very unethical. If you think, if you remember your Greek literature. And if they're immoral, and if they're unethical, why should man be any different? And that was the culture that they tried to give to the Jewish people. It's tragedy. Classical tragedy. Well, the Jewish people want to give hope. Tikva to the world. That's the national anthem of the Jewish people. Tikva. It's hope. Hope for the future. A brighter tomorrow. So that was in Hebrew you will call it the Pumus Yavan Neged Israel. That was the battle of the Greeks against the Jewish people. And the Jewish people fought for religious freedom. That's what Hanukkah was about. It's about religious freedom. It was a clash of civilizations. It wasn't just Hellenizing the Jewish people. It was a clash of values. It was a confrontation between two great cultures. And I'm not taking anything away from the Greeks, even though I'm describing them from the vantage point of Judaism in quite a disparaging way. But it was the ancient Greeks that gave us the great Western civilization that we live in today, and all of the comforts and all of the benefits and all of the wisdom that we have, and all of the scientific innovations and all of the technology that we have. All of that has been benefited by Western civilization that was begun by the Greeks. And they are the ones who constructed our society. But yet the Jewish people continue to live as they continue even in that time. Which brings me to the next part of what I'd like to discuss, which is, so how do we celebrate Hanukkah? How do we celebrate Hanukkah? Because what I left out was something that we find in the actual prayers. Now, if you remember, in the prayers, we have an interesting prayer. For most holidays, we say, Yalla V'yavo. Right? If you're acquainted with the Siddur, with the liturgy, it's Yalla V'yavo. That's the holiday thing. You say it on Rosh Chodesh, and you say it on all the holidays. Shabbos has got its own say. Everybody's got their own thing. Now, on Hanukkah, we don't do that. It's not like that kind of a holiday. But we do have a prayer that we inject in the actual tefillah, in the Shemona Esrei, which is called Al HaNisim. The miracles. It's a holiday of miracles. Now, what miracles do we discuss in the liturgy? We discuss a very simple miracle, which is you had a bunch of priests. Could you just get the image? A bunch of priests with their garments working in the temple, confronting the Greek army that conquered the world. The Macedonians conquered the entire world and the ancient civilization. They replaced the Persians. And the Peloponnesian war, they replaced the Persians. They destroyed the Persian Empire. And they come into these little Yidalach, and a small band of priests. We go, Judah Maccabee. Okay, he might have, he's a cool priest. But he's a priest. That's what he was trained to do. He wasn't a trained soldier. And they were able to rout the entire Greek army. They threw them the heck out of Israel. Is that miraculous? I think it's 67. Is that miraculous or not? It's miraculous. And that's what we do in the Al Hanisim. It's an incredible miracle. You wouldn't believe it. You wouldn't believe it. Unless, except that it happened. And that's what we talk about. Rabim Mayad Ma'atim. There were many in the hands of few. You know, Zaydim Be'aroske Sarasech. A bunch of Talmidei Chacham. A bunch of rabbis against trained soldiers. These MMA fighters with weapons. With pitchforks against cannons. That's how they won. And that's what the prayer is about. That's a miracle. So no, how come nobody talks about that? Nobody talks about that. You don't find that in the Talmud. As a matter of fact, the Talmud even says, my Hanukkah, what's Hanukkah? What's Hanukkah? And they tell you the story about the oil. The oil. That's the big deal. Go to any Hebrew school. Ask the kids. What?
Well, it was the oil.
They only had enough oil for one day and at least for 8 days. Hallelujah. Leonard Cohen, I love you. That's what it's about. And we light the candles and we make the blessings and we sing the songs and we spin the dreidel. It's beautiful. It's a festival of lights. Now, why would they do that? Celebrate the victory. Have Armistice Day. Have a July 4th celebration. That would be great. You like lights? Light up the sky. It's a very, very unusual kind of a thing. The first miracle, the great miracle, is something that really is shoved under the rug. That the Jews routed the Greek army. And yet, there's meaning in that. Why do we celebrate in that manner? So I'd like to just share an insight with you. That comes from a very great rabbi. He died in the 1930s, and he was known as a very great genius. And you may have heard his name. His name is Rabbi Meir Simcha HaKohen of Dvinsk. Okay, maybe you didn't hear his name. But he wrote a book, a very famous book called Meshech Chachma. Very famous work. As it happens, he wrote it when he was 17. He was a prodigy. And in it, he answers this question. He tries to address it. It's a good question. Excellent question. And he says that, in fact, Jews don't like to celebrate victory over enemies. Because to achieve a victory over your enemy, you have to kill people. Now, war is hell. Sometimes it's necessary. When you're attacked, you have to defend yourself. But in fact, every war is tragic. Because many people die, and many innocent people die. Just yesterday, they uncovered that in Syria, men, women, and children, in the thousands, were massacred. We're inured to it, because you hear it every single day. It's a horrible thing. Church in Egypt was firebombed. Also, dozens of people were killed, hundreds injured. It's tragic. And yet you see people, the ones who do it, like ISIS, they're happy as can be. We killed people. So he says the Jews don't do that. As a matter of fact, he says, even when it comes to Pesach, the great holiday of our redemption from Egypt, the angels wanted to sing praise to God when the Egyptians died in the Red Sea. And God said, what are you singing a song? Ma'aseh yodai tovim v'yam ma'atem omrim shiva. Your enemies, that's true, they had to be dispatched, but these are human beings. These are my children, and they died. And therefore, that's why we don't celebrate, says Rabbi Meir Simcha HaKohen of Dvinsk. We don't celebrate. We have to talk about it. It's a miracle. We have to be mindful of it. You have to defend yourself against your enemies. You've got to be strong. But it's not something that we celebrate. Because it was death. And that we don't do. So what do we do? We always accentuate what was the positive. What happened that was positive from that encounter? And he says, what they did was, there was something known as Chanukah. Chanukah. What does that mean, Chanukah? Many explanations. But the most basic explanation was they rededicated the temple. Chanukah Tamizbeach. Say that at the end of Mo'oz Sur. Chanukat HaMizbeach. Okay, I can't sing. I want to sing it first. Okay. No, it's the end. It's the end. We don't need the beginning. Okay. And that is what we accentuate. Now, so how do you do that? What was the positive? Now, another little dirty secret about Hanukkah, that's why it's so hard to talk about it, is that so many Jews became Hellenists, known as Mityavnim, and they turned against their co-religionists, they turned against children, against their parents, wives against the husbands, to embrace Greek culture. And they rejected Judaism. As a matter of fact, according to the second book of Maccabees, it was the Jews who caused more destruction in the temple than the Greeks. It was the Jews who killed more other Jews than the Greeks. The Jews. There was a mix-up of Jewish identity. They thought that they could be good Jews and good Greeks at the same time, when in fact, that was not possible. So that Rabbi Meir Simcha Cohen Advin says that the miracle of Hanukkah was a rededication to the Jewish identity. That's what it was. To reclaim Judaism. That Judaism was able to be reclaimed by people. And there are reasons why it has to be positive. And it has to be light. I just want to say a word about Jewish identity today. I just have a few more minutes. I want to talk about that. Many people have only one kind of identity to the Judaism. Many, many people here in the United States. And that's the Holocaust. And I'm not, God forbid, believe me, in my synagogue we do a lot of Holocaust stuff. And we should. We shouldn't forget. But to many people, that's their total identification with Judaism. They're survivors, or their parents were survivors, their grandparents were survivors. It's about the Holocaust. It's about the Shoah. And the religious experience is, go to Washington, you go to the Holocaust Museum. That's the religious identity. There's nothing else that they do, nothing else they know about. Jews? Yeah. Holocaust. And that's not a positive identity. If this is how we're going to teach Judaism to our children about the Holocaust, that's it. There was a Holocaust. They wanted to kill us, and now we're for social justice. If that's the sum total of Judaism, it really throws off a very, very bad message. The message is that there's nothing positive. We have no mission. There are no values. There's no core mission statement that we can make. But it's about escaping death. It's about escaping anti-Semitism. Everybody hates the Jew and they want to kill the Jew. But thank God they weren't successful. They killed 6 million, 7 million, but they weren't successful in killing all of us. That's not a positive way of describing Judaism. And certainly we know this. We know this if you go to high school, and certainly even Hebrew day schools and Jewish schools, you can't get kids to sit through a Holocaust presentation. They don't want to know about it. Because it's so negative. It's so much about death. Many people have only one identity, and that's the state of Israel. And that's a powerful identity. Powerful identity. And it's a wonderful identity. But for many people, as you know, if you look at the heads of the BDS, and if you look at what is taking place in the campus, many of the anti-Israeli groups are led by Jews. There's nothing that binds them to the state of Israel. There are no Jewish values. No core values that they have. It's all about suffering and persecution. If that's what Judaism stands for, Holocaust, well, guess what? We're causing the Palestinians suffering and persecution. So that we're not being Jewish. And they became the new Jews. So that the lessons of Hanukkah, if they would guide us today, they would tell us something about sanctity. They would tell us something about true Jewish values. They would tell us that the only way for us to transmit Judaism to the next generation is to inject some kedusha, some sanctification in the way that we live. And it's not that difficult. If you remember at the very beginning, the bris, forget about it. The kid didn't ask, he's 8 days old, he's done. But in the very beginning, we spoke about Kiddush. Now, everybody has varying levels of Sabbath observance. But I remember growing up, many people were not Shomer Shabbos. They worked on Shabbos. They couldn't subsist otherwise, and they believed that if they didn't work on Shabbos, they would all die from starvation. But I do remember that even before going out to the movies, women would light Hanukkah, would light Shabbos candles, and the family would be around when she lit the Shabbos candles. Father may still have been at work in the winter, but she lit Shabbos candles. So at least the children had some kind of sanctified light. A father can make Kiddush, sanctify the Shabbos. It's not either all or nothing at all. Now, I'm not here preaching not to keep Shabbos. I hope that you know that. But it's not either all or nothing at all. But there's so much that we can do to shore up our Jewish identity. Because it's slipping away. It's slipping away. If you remember the Pew report that came out just 2 years ago, it showed 70% assimilation. That's gigantic. 70%. And they said that was a conservative estimate. That means 7 out of every Jewish boys and girls are marrying out of the faith. And it's not a matter of who's a Jew. Are offspring Jewish? That's not what we're talking about. Because in 2 generations, nobody's going to care. Nobody's going to care at all. We have to give the children, if it's important to us, it may not be important to us, but if it's important for us, for our children to marry Jews, we have to give them some reason why it's important. Not because we say so, or because they wanted to kill us in the Holocaust to marry a Jewish girl. Well, it doesn't have any impact on the people. So that the lesson of Hanukkah that we need for today is that we need to identify ourselves properly as Jews, based upon Jewish culture, based upon Jewish ideals, based upon Jewish history, based upon the Torah, based upon the mitzvahs. And that's such an interesting thing, and I'm going to end with that. To me, it's mystifying. And maybe you could help me with this. We spend, the Jewish community at large, spend millions and millions of dollars on Jewish continuity. That's one of the big birthright, very successful for what it's supposed to be. And we spend really lots of money with Hillels on every campus. Millions and millions of dollars. UGA Federation dedicates themselves to Jewish continuity. And yet we watch as the Jewish population, our children and grandchildren, slowly slip away from us. Meaning to say that it's not working. It's not working. Intelligent people, when you do an experiment, especially when it costs millions of dollars, and it's not working, have to realize that you've got to try something else. And what mystifies me is that whenever there's a dedication to Torah and to mitzvos, that's how you keep Jewish people Jewish. And whenever there's not, that's how you drive assimilation. And yet, despite the clear evidence, it's just mystifying. Because it's clear. It's clear. In the Pew report, they found that orthodoxy is growing. And believe me, I'm orthodox. We don't take any great triumph in that we're expanding and everybody else is losing. Because we're all Jews. There's no such thing. The labels are artificial. If somebody is a Jewish boy or a Jewish girl who leaves the faith, that's my son and my daughter. I care what the affiliation is? What kind of nonsense is that? Jew is a Jew, period, exclamation point. So we take no delight in it, but yet the studies show that the other movements are not able to keep the kids. They're losing them. Forget about intermarriage. They're not even there intermarried. They're not in the synagogue, they're not in the system intermarried. So you see that the only way to do it is to concentrate on Torah and mitzvahs. Doesn't mean you have to have payas and a long beard and not do anything and abandon Western culture. But it certainly means that a person should embrace what is naturally theirs. Take what somebody else is, but couple it with what's already yours. Why cast away what's yours? And I think that's the difficult, horrible fact of what Hanukkah is. Hanukkah is to try to bring back Jewish identity through the only way that Jewish identity works, which is a fealty, which is a loyalty to God's Torah and to his mitzvahs. Because why in the world do you think he gave it to us? And he tells you why. He tells you in the Torah 100 times, for it to be good for you. The Torah and the mitzvahs for Jews are to make it good, to make you happy. Because that's what the whole point of the Torah is, for Jews to have happy, fulfilling, meaningful lives, and to have a Jewish identity they can be proud of. And they can proudly say, yes, we're Jews. Proudly say, our country is Israel. Proudly say, we're good Americans, loyal Americans, we're patriots. But at the very same time, not to compromise our religious values, our religious identity, and that would be the greatest victory over the Greeks, and that would be the victory of Hanukkah. So, I hope I didn't offend anybody by any by my words. I know Jews are very touchy. I'm saying it only with love. Believe me, I feel desperate. I feel desperate. By the way, Orthodoxy also losing many people. Very, very difficult with the lack of connection. Connections to anything religious are very difficult these days, and we're all struggling. All of us are struggling. Never mind what the Pew report says. I know facts on the ground. So we're all suffering. And I think the answer for all of us is the same. Jewish identity, Jewish values. Feel proud that we're Jews, and being Jewish is Torah mitzvahs. Thank you very much.
Questions.
Please, Baruch Hashem. Great opportunity.
Who asked where the refreshments? They were in that room. Yeah.
Why do we countenance the Catholic version of the Maccabean story? Why do we take that seriously if it's from another religion?
It's not Catholic. The truth is, it was written by Jews and it was written in the Second Temple period.
Oh, okay.
I'm just saying that the body of literature, there were many books, many, many books, we abandoned them because they weren't written with divine inspiration, so they were not part of the canon. We have, our books are part of the holy canon,
like
the scripture.
A history book.
It could be more than a history book, depending on who wrote it, but it's an account. It's a semi-reliable account of what took place, so it's important. I just said that the church kept those books. They had them in Latin, and they might be part of the Vulgate Bible, and St. Jerome translated them into good Latin from the Greek, and they kept those books for us. So I'm happy they did, because now we have a lot of information. But they're not Holy Scripture, and the rabbis only canonized Holy Scripture. Sir?
There's something that you were talking about, the reluctance to emphasize the military, and instead the emphasis was put on the
right.
Miracle of the life. I remember hearing something about the reluctance might have had something to do with the fact that the Hashmonim established a dynasty, which they were kings as well as priests.
So this is what you heard.
There was a civil war.
I can tell you what you heard. I can tell you what you heard.
Yeah.
The question, what you heard is the answer to the following question.
Yeah.
Every holiday has a series of Mishnah, of oral tradition about every holiday. Tractates. Tractate for Shabbos, tractate for Pesach, a tractate for Sukkot, right? The tractate for everyone. There's not one mention of Hanukkah in any Mishnah. None. Why is that? So the answer you heard comes from the Chassam Sofer. At least it's traditionally from the Chassam Sofer. I don't believe the Chassam Sofer ever said it, by the way. But they say that he said it. It's not in any of his writings. They said that since the kingdom, royalty, was given to the tribe of Judah, and the priestly tradition is to the tribe of Levi, or in this case, the Kohen people, the children of Aharon, and when they were able to drive out the Greeks, they took the monarchy for themselves, that's the Hasmonean dynasty. Therefore, Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, who was the redactor of the Mishnah, who was a direct descendant of King David, said, you did the wrong thing, I'm going to omit you from the Mishnah. That's what you heard. But I doubt if it's true. Want to hear an answer from Rabbi Reuven Margolius, the great scholar of Hebrew University? In his book, Chaker LeTalmud, he says, I don't know if it's true either, but it's very interesting. He says that the Greeks, as well as the Romans later, were very, this is, if you were empire, you'd understand this. Empires that conquer are very sensitive to insurrection, to rebellion. And if there's any suspicion of rebellion, they would quickly put it down by massacring people. And therefore, any mention whatsoever of any Jewish identity or Jewish things that are uniquely Jewish that are external are not mentioned. As a matter of fact, he says the same thing. Right? If they would talk about the victory, we celebrate the victory. So you have the Greeks occupying every city, and you have the Romans occupying every city, right? And then the Jews say, "Yay, we drove the enemy out." So you're going to get very sensitive about it. The Romans would kill Jews if they would do that. The Greeks would kill Jews if they did that. And therefore, he didn't want to put it in the Mishnah. We don't talk about that victory. Nobody cares about the candles. Nobody cares about your dumb oil. So you can do it. And he says, for the same reason, there's no Masechta Tefillin. There's no Mishnayos about Tefillin. There's no Mishnayos about Tzitzis. Because these are outward manifestations of Judaism. So during that period, there was no record of it. That's his answer. I don't know if that's true either, but those are the answers. Okay. Freshman's in there? Yeah? No, just. No, go ahead.
No, your hand.
Your hand, too. Yeah. Yes, Rabbi Zaitchik. Don't make it too hard. Give me an easy question.
Yeah, we have, a very special group of individuals here tonight, and I think all of us appreciate your message to the team. I'd like to know if you have any advice. You know, sometimes getting kids, teens, who in today's assimilated world may not appreciate the message, is sometimes that's very challenging. Perhaps you have one or two thoughts about how we here might be able to succeed in reaching our kids and teenagers.
I think that children always learn by example. If they see a parent is serious about something, then the message is a serious message. That's what I believe. You can't say something and not do it. Or else it's not important. If it's important, you do it. So when daddy and mommy say that that's important, they do it, I see that it's important to them. If it's important to them, they're important to me, so maybe it's important to me too. I think that's the only way. All the talking is of no consequence. Sorry, it's not a better answer, but that's what I believe. I also, just one more thing. I also believe that Jews have, as a group, have lost a little bit of their integrity. It used to be that when a Jew said something, even the people who hated Jews killed them, but they knew that when a Jew gave his word, it's as good as gold. Jews are honest in business, and Jews never say something and mean something else. And I think a lot of what has happened to us across the board as Jews is that we've lost a little bit of that integrity, a little bit of that honesty. And I think that our children see that. They think that everything else is fake. You know, the Kitzur Shulchan Aruch says if you have to teach one lesson to a child, teach him never to lie. He says that's why you're not allowed to spank a child. Who ran the car through the garage door? And if the kid says, me, you can't punish the child because then you're teaching him not to tell the truth. This is my kid, I wallop up. But anyway, that's what he says. It's honesty. And our children see that we're not 100% in terms of honesty. In business, children see everything. They see everything. And to them, you can't say, one second, I'm a business person. And in business, this is how business is run. Look at our president. This is how business is run. And then when it comes to other kinds of things, you have to be honest and you have to be and have integrity and your word has to be a word. You can't ever lie. It doesn't work. It's a bifurcated message. And the children pick it up immediately. So we have to be consistent. Okay. Refreshments in there.
I'd like to thank Rabbi Fink. Yes, everybody. It's a great privilege to have you with us and to be inspired by your beautiful.
It's my privilege, believe me.